Next case, the United States v. Hunter. Ms. Mullen.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. The Supreme Court instructs that in determining whether or not a suspect unambiguously invoked his right to counsel, context matters. Circumstances matter. And in fact, in Davis, the Supreme Court said that if a reasonable officer, in light of those circumstances, would have understood only that a defendant or a suspect might be invoking his right to counsel, that questioning need not cease, and officers in those circumstances are encouraged to ask clarifying questions. So let's look at the circumstances in this case. And as we do, I would ask the panel to ask yourselves, did anything happen in this case, in these circumstances, that offends your constitutional sensibilities? So we have Detective Carson transporting the defendant. He is not the investigator assigned to the case, and he knows that. He understands that because this is a police officer-involved shooting, that he will not be investigating the case. He is merely transporting the defendant and guarding the defendant. He makes no communication with the defendant. He does not approach the defendant. He transports him to the hospital and is quietly sitting in the background in the hospital room, not speaking to the defendant. It's the defendant who says, "Is there a police officer present?" At that point, Detective Carson steps forward, introduces himself to the defendant, and immediately Mirandizes him. Then Detective Carson says, "Do you wish to speak to me?" The defendant said, "Well, yeah, I do, but could you give me a minute to think?" Detective Carson abides by that request, says nothing to the defendant, gives him the minute that he asks for. The defendant then says, "Could you tell me what I'm charged with?" Detective Carson doesn't know. He's not the investigator. He wasn't on the scene when this happened. So he steps out of the hospital room to inquire of the other officers who are present. They tell him what they know. Detective Carson goes back in, again keeping defendant in the driver's seat, says, "Well, what I know is that a gun was found at the scene." And the defendant says, "So they have me for felon in possession." And he says, "It appears that way." The defendant then says, starts making a series of requests to this detective. "Can you call my mother and father?" "Sure, can you give me their names and their numbers?" "Yeah," and he provides those. "Can you call my attorney, Herb Schultz?" The detective at this point does what any person in that situation would do, a very natural, benign response, which is, "Sure, what do you want me to tell these people?" Had the detective not asked the defendant that, how would he have known what he was to tell these people? Let's put ourselves in that position for a minute. It's different when a defendant says, "I want to speak to my attorney." Why? Because the defendant has then put himself in the driver's seat. He's driving at that point. You can hand the defendant a phone. The defendant can call his attorney and tell his attorney whatever he wants to tell his attorney. But here the defendant did something that was slightly different. He made a series of requests to the detective. And the detective wants to abide by those requests. He wants to fulfill those requests, as he's been doing all along. So what he says to the defendant is, "What do you want me to tell those people?" Again, an open-ended, benign, legitimate, clarifying question. And that's what the Supreme Court in Davis said these officers are supposed to do. And then we see what happens after that, where the defendant is then removed from the room to go down to radiology for a CAT scan. Again, Detective Carson accompanies the defendant, sits in the background, says nothing. The defendant asks the radiologist, "Is the detective still present?" The radiologist assumed or understood the defendant to be asking, "May I speak to the detective?" and said, "No, you're going to have to wait till we're finished, and then you can speak to the detective." They go back to the emergency room where they started, and again, the defendant says, "Is the detective still present?" And at that point, the detective turns over the defendant to the other two officers, tells them what has happened up to that point, excuses himself, and leaves. So when we look at these circumstances, what here offends our constitutional sensibilities?
Well, what bothered Judge Mim was, what was the point of the question in response to, "Can you call my lawyer," if not to create some ambiguity in what facially might objectively be viewed as a request for counsel.
That is what Judge Mim thought, but let's think about that for a minute. The ambiguity was already there. When the defendant said, can you call my mother, my father, and my attorney, there are a million different things that the defendant might have wanted the officer to say.
Wait a minute, though. It follows on the heels of the advice of rights and the defendant's response to those, saying, yeah, I'll cooperate, but I need to think about that, and then learning of the seriousness of the charge, one that's pretty hard to beat, and then the statement, can you call my lawyer?
And I so, and Judge Sander, yeah, it's
and Judge Mim focused on that.
And it's entirely appropriate to view this, or for the detective to have viewed this, that the defendant might be asking for counsel. That's certainly a possibility under these circumstances. But again, the defendant might not be asking for counsel. And what we see when the detective asked the appropriate, legitimate, clarifying question is that the defendant wasn't asking for counsel. The defendant, and you know, as the case goes on and the defendant eventually...
Sort of a tactical point of view, mm-hmm. why do you even care about the statement? Because you've got him firing the weapon, mm-hmm. seen by the police, you've recovered the gun, it's got a spent shell, and he makes that statement about you got me as a felon in possession, which is admissible right. under Judge Mim's ruling. What more do you need?
That's a fair question.
Why are you pushing this, potentially getting an adverse ruling on this from an mm-hmm. appellate court?
Many people have had many discussions about that exact issue. And all the way up to the SG's office.
Right.
And the decision was made that given the certain problems of proof in the case, certain problems with some of the police work in the case, and the obvious defense that could be mounted, which is that the gun was planted, given all the circumstances of the case, that it was necessary or important to have the defendant's confession here. So that was something that was seriously considered and weighed, and ultimately the decision was made that it was important for us to pursue this.
But you could have a state charge here, too, I suppose.
There was a state charge, actually. We got a petite waiver in this case. So the defendant was charged in state court with three charges, the possession of the gun, aggravated discharge, and attempted murder.
Ms. Mullen, how much difference is can you call my attorney versus will you call my attorney?
Well, I think that that's why we have to look at the circumstances. You know, my eyes glaze over.
Well, I understand the ambiguity argument or the circumstances argument, but what? Why should especially a detective, but any law enforcement officer, want to inquire or have after Mirandizing somebody, inquire into what would be the nature of your conversation with the lawyer?
Well, I think what he was saying, what he was asking the defendant is, you've now given me three people to call. What would you like me to tell these people? Are you asking them to come down? Do you want me to tell them you've been shot?
I don't know if the record shows whether Carson was aware that Schultz had represented Hunter before.
No.
We don't know whether he did or not. Well, but that is the fact, right? That he was asking to contact somebody who had represented him prior.
He asked for his attorney, Herb Schultz. So presumably, you know, that's what he
Do you have any case close factually to this? I understand the context argument, Ms. Mullen, but I remain a little puzzled, as does Judge Tinder, obviously, on where the government feels it needs to go with this case.
I think all of the cases, you know, we have very different facts in all of the cases, but let's look at the Hampton case, which is the one of the more recent cases out of this circuit. If you look in isolation at the words that were used there, that were the focus of the appeal, which is, are you asking to speak to an attorney? Yes, I am, but. And ultimately, this court found that that was not an unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel, because in context, what we have is a defendant who started out by saying, yes, I want to invoke my right to counsel, then changed his mind upon being taken to his cell, changed his mind again, and is engaging these police officers on and off. And so,
how about the Weisinger case? How is this different than the Weisinger case?
Well, in Weisinger, we start with, do I need a lawyer before we start talking? This court found that that was equivocal. Then we have...
He gets to the point where he says, can I call one now?
I mean, do you think I need a lawyer? Equivocal. I mean, but can I call one now? And I think that, again, I'll go back to that sort of keeping the defendant in the driver's seat analogy. When you look at a lot of these cases where this court and other courts have found that there was the invocation, the defendant is asking to do something. So we have, can I have a lawyer? I mean, but can I call one now? I think I should get a lawyer. I think I should call my lawyer. This defendant is asking to do things. In our case, we have a defendant asking the police officer to do something. So it's different if
defendant... he's been shot twice. He can't get up and walk over to the phone. He's got to ask somebody.
He has a free hand, Your Honor. He has one free hand. Okay. Of course, the phone could be brought to him, and that's typically what happens in these situations. But my point was, there's a difference between...
Is Detective Carson asking, in effect, do you want to discuss about a real estate closing? I mean, you ask us to look at context, Ms. Mullen.
What
would he possibly want to talk to this lawyer about, other than possible defense, I guess?
Well, and as I think that in the full context of everything that happened afterwards, we see a defendant who basically is acting very indignant about what happened here and is making a point repeatedly to tell the officers, you need to understand that I was shot when I was down. I gave up and, you know, threw my hands out, and this officer continues to shoot me. And in the context later when he's talking to the detectives, and brings up his attorney's name again, it's directly on the heels of saying, I was shot when I was down. And sort of the suggestion or implication there is that he was feeling very righteously indignant about this and that there might be a lawsuit, which is actually pending at this point. So I mean, there's all sorts of reasons.
Let's take that as a reasonable assumption. How does that impact this inquiry about calling parents and calling counsel?
If we know from Davis that if an officer thinks the defendant might be asking for counsel, it's appropriate to clarify. What more benign, open-ended question could we have here than what the officer asked? What we're concerned about in other cases is a police officer, through questioning, through these thinly veiled clarification questions that we see in some of these cases, actually attempting to get a defendant to change his mind. Those sorts of questions where a police officer will say, are you sure that's what you want to do? Because do you understand that if you do that, we can't talk anymore and you'll be giving up any opportunity that you have to cooperate with us? That's not what happened here. We have a single question. Okay, what do you want me to tell these people? Completely open-ended. And no coercion there, no trickery there, keeping the defendant in the driver's seat, and he says, tell them I've been shot.
Did Hunter ever follow up or suggest to either Carson or the subsequent officers that he had requested his counsel to be present?
Never. And when he was Mirandized the second time, he agreed to talk to the officers and talk to them for over an hour in great detail about, you know, spinning his tale about what had happened that day. Never once said, wait a minute, I earlier asked for my attorney, or why hasn't anyone called my attorney? Because that's not what he was asking for at the time. And that was made clear by his response to the detective.
Is it the government's position that when he asks Ms. Mullen, can you call my attorney? He's just making an inquiry about the capacity of the detective to call?
Well, we see that in some cases where they say, can I get an attorney, or I can't afford an attorney, but could I still get one, where a defendant is asking, what his or her rights and responsibilities are in that particular case.
Yeah,
and
so he personalizes this. He has an attorney. He talks about my attorney. So that it isn't like he's unfamiliar with the criminal justice system. I guess as a follow-up, do we know whether Detective Carson knows he's dealing with someone who has priors?
No, he didn't know anything about the defendant.
He's essentially babysitting,
and he's transporting him from one place to the other, didn't know anything about this particular offense or the defendant.
But he is a detective.
He is a detective, but all he's done is report to the scene, been assigned to transport the defendant to the hospital, and he's standing guard until the people who are going to be investigating show up. So that was his role here. If we look at it, and I see my time has expired, but one last point. If the defendant had said, could you call my mother, call my father, and call my attorney and tell them I've been shot, we wouldn't be here. And so really what we're looking at is one question that separates, an open-ended question that separates the three requests and the final part of the request that clarifies what the defendant is asking for.
No, I understand, Ms. Bowen, to say, if he had said, could you call my attorney, that we would have a different case?
I was saying if he had said, can you call my mother and my father and my attorney and tell them I've been shot, I think that would be a different case. Then I don't think we would be here at that point. So what I'm saying is it's artificial to separate out the and decide that it's legally insignificant what he said after an open-ended benign question. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowen.
Good morning. George Tassif with the Federal Public Defender for Casey Hunter. Controlling case authority from this circuit, from the 11th Circuit, and the 9th Circuit, reviewing almost identical language of a suspect, holds that statements such as, quote, can I have a lawyer, unquote, U.S. versus Lee from this court, was sufficient and unequivocal. United States versus Weisinger from ICE court, quote, can I call a lawyer now, unquote, was found to be sufficiently clear and unambiguous. The statement, quote, can I call my lawyer, unquote, was found by the Ninth Circuit, U.S. versus De La Yara, to be sufficient. And finally, in Kennedy versus Duggar, the 11th Circuit, quote, I think I should call my lawyer, unquote, all four of those cases held that that language was sufficient to lead a reasonable officer
know. That's not quite right, is it? They didn't hold that language viewed in isolation was sufficient to violate the rights.
No,
didn't they all employ a totality of the circumstances?
Indeed, because that's the Davis test. So point number two, context is everything. And in this case, I urge the court to review the transcript of the motion to suppress, pages 18 through 24, so this court can see the sworn chronology of what actually happened between Detective Carson and Mr. Hunter at the emergency room. As soon as Hunter was taken to the ER, handcuffed to a gurney, placed in the ER, Hunter was heard by Carson as asking whether any officers were present. Carson, who was in plain clothes, steps forward and identifies himself as a police officer and immediately Mirandizes him. Hunter states then, I understand my rights. Carson asks what happened. He wasn't just some babysitter designed to sit there for the hour and a half before the state police investigators arrived. Carson, at that point, affirmatively asked what happened, and Mr. Hunter said he did not know. Carson then follows up and says if he would like to talk to him, Carson. And that's when Mr. Hunter said, I'm willing to talk, but I'd like a minute to think about this. And then after a minute or so, Hunter asked Carson what he was going to be charged with. Carson didn't know at that point since he had arrived at the scene of the shooting after it had occurred. So Hunter went out to talk to a police officer in the hallway who said a gun was found at the scene, and then came back into the room and told Hunter that he was going to be charged with felon in possession of a firearm. So, at that point, that's when Hunter says, so you're going to get me for felon in possession? Carson acknowledged, yes, that's on page 23 of the record. That is when Hunter says, hey, can you call my mother and my father? And here are their addresses or their phone numbers. So Carson takes that information. And after Hunter had requested that Carson call mom and dad, that's when Hunter specifically states, can you call my attorney, Herb Schultz? Now, Carson doesn't respond by saying, what do you want me to tell, or what do you want to ask Mr. Schultz? What are you going to tell Mr. Schultz, your attorney? He says, question, what do you want me to tell these people? And Hunter, who's strapped to the gurney with the handcuff, who reports or registers by the ER records a 10 out of 10 pain scale, says, tell them I've been shot. Now, when I argued this case before the district court last January 3rd, I inquired and asked almost flippantly of Judge Mim, what would he possibly have intended or thought by asking that the officer call my attorney, Herb Schultz, specifically isolate that question as to the lawyer? And I went on flippantly to suggest, was he asking Mr. Carson to have Mr. Schultz send Hunter a get-well card at the hospital? Why else would anybody who's been Mirandized and told he's going to be charged with felon in possession specifically ask the officer, can you call my lawyer, Herb Schultz, other than he intends that the lawyer be brought for consultation? And certainly, and this was the 800-pound gorilla in the courtroom that day, because Carson understood the import of what Hunter was asking for, because from that point on, he scrupulously refrained from asking any more questions of Mr. Hunter. And more importantly, an hour or so later, when Morrissey and Detective George show up to take over, Carson tells them everything that occurred, including Hunter asking Carson to call his attorney, Herb Schultz. I pressed Carson at the motion hearing. It's in the transcript. And it got him to admit that he was certain that he conveyed that information to Special Agent Morrissey when she came on the scene to take over the investigation.
Detective Carson indicate in his testimony what he understood Mr. Hunter to be to intend by asking him to call Mr. Schultz?
He professed to say, I believe, as I recall from the record, that he wasn't clear what Hunter wanted him to do with respect to the lawyer. And that's why he asked this follow-up. But that's just not reasonable from this record, because any reasonable officer would know after Mirandizing a suspect under these circumstances that when an individual says, can you call my attorney, Herb Schultz, whom Carson knew as a veteran criminal defense lawyer in the Quad Cities, who has offices in Rock Island, Illinois, and with whom Carson has worked in numerous federal and state criminal cases. This wasn't some stranger that Hunter was asking Carson about. Carson put a lid on it and no longer asked any questions, and then conveys that to Morrissey, who under oath said she could not recall, nor did she remember Carson ever saying anything about the request for counsel. So then they approach Hunter, Mirandize him, and another hour or so of interrogation occurs where they get this statement that's subject to the motion. And Judge Mim, at the motion to reconsider, said on the record, I can't fathom what anybody would say under that circumstance in response to that question that would be incriminating. So clearly, a request for counsel on its face and under the circumstances is sufficient to request counsel under Miranda. Was honored by Detective Carson, but not by Morrissey and George. This is a clear-cut violation of the Edwards rule. And anything that happened from that point on when Hunter said, call my attorney Herb Schultz, under Smith versus Illinois, U.S. versus Martin, U.S. versus Hampton, a host of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court and this court, you don't use subsequent responses to cast doubt upon the validity of the earlier invocation of the defendant's rights.
Well, don't cases recognize that the absence of any follow-up by a defendant is quite probative of whether the invocation was to invoke the right of counsel as opposed to something.
This issue
more
came
ambiguous?
Up in a case that Ms. Mullen and I argued, U.S. versus Martin. I would ask the court to consider Judge Wood's dissent in that case. But yes, there is that tension about whether later on, if the suspect does not reiterate the request, whether that can be considered. But here, the argument seems to be from the government that they're trying to cast doubt upon the earlier invocation by Hunter's response, tell them I've been shot, notwithstanding the question that was posed to him was by Carson, who put it in the plural tense. What do you want me to tell those people? He had specifically asked that the officer call his attorney, and that was sufficient, especially under these circumstances. There's no reasonable way we can interpret this record any differently, and I respectfully ask that this court affirm Judge Mims' order of suppression.
Thank you, Mr. Tessa. Ms. Mullen, I think your time had expired, but you may have 2 minutes.
Thank you. One thing we've been focusing on a little bit here today is what could the officer have possibly thought that the defendant meant when he said, can you call my attorney, Herb Schultz? But if we look at some of the questions that were asked in other cases where this court found that the defendant did not invoke his right to counsel, those include, this is Shabazz, am I going to be able to get an attorney? Well, what else could that defendant have meant? How about, I can't afford a lawyer, but is there any way I can get one? So again, that's why we have to go back to context. It's really important that we look at the entire context, because we can play this game, right? We can pluck all of these statements out of context. In two of the cases that Mr. Tassif cited, where the defendant was found to have invoked his right to counsel, the court very specifically said in those cases it would have been fine for a police officer at that point to have asked a clarifying question, but the police officer didn't do that, either went on to interrogate or did something else. So again, our point here, our focus here is we want to abide by the Supreme Court's advice in Davis. We want police officers in these circumstances to be asking the benign kind of clarifying question that we have here, the open-ended clarifying question, not those sort of tricky, we're really trying to get you to change your mind clarifying questions. But in a situation like this, we want police officers to ask those clarifying questions. And this court has said that time and time again, including in Hampton, that this is exactly what we want these officers to do in these situations where there could be any ambiguity at all. Just ask the question, what are you asking for here? What do you want? If the defendant had said nothing about his parents and had just said, can you call my attorney, Herb Schultz? And the officer had said, okay, or can you call my attorney? Okay, what's his name and number?
Is there any sort of statement the defendant could have made that would not have permitted a clarification, would not have permitted some additional question?
I've given that so much thought, Judge Tinder, because I think that it's not just a question of clarifying. It's a question of what we're trying to encourage officers to do and what we're trying to dissuade them from doing. And so I think in a situation, if a defendant said something, anything short of, I want my attorney right now, bring me the phone, anything short of that, even then I think an officer should be able to say something as benign as, do you have your attorney's number?
So in your view, questioning doesn't end when the invocation of counsel is made.
I think any kind of interrogation questioning has to end. I think anything that would be designed to undercut what the defendant has asked for or take him out of the driver's seat would be impermissible. But I think as long as that detective or officer is simply asking an open-ended clear or not even clarifying, just a question. Okay, what is your attorney's name? Or do you feel comfortable sitting up now to make the call now? I mean, there's all sorts of benign conversation that could occur in that situation. And I think we need to be careful not to get down in the weeds on these things and decide and parse out words. And what we really want to do is look at the policies animating these decisions and say, what do we want to have officers do in situations like this? And I go back to what happened here that offends your constitutional sensibilities. We have an officer who asked one benign question, and the defendant then made it clear that he wasn't asking for counsel. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Mr. Tassett, thank you. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.